Accession number 8736, rule number 35.
Lord Harding, tape 35. Could I ask you now about the relationship between the British troops and the German population? Did this change in any way?
Yes, there was a change in progress. You see, when I went to Germany to take over the Rhine Army, the wartime order that there was to be no fraternization between the Allied troops and the German civilian population was still in force. And this was very difficult for the troops to understand why it should continue. And there was pressure building up, particularly from the Corps of Officers in Rhine Army, that they ought to be allowed to get about more and to use the sort of French, German cafes and entertainment resources and that sort of thing. And so this was put to me. And I decided to make a relaxation in the orders for the Corps of Officers of the Rhine Army, giving them permission to allowing them to mix more freely with, well, mix freely with the German population and attend, and go to German places of entertainment and so on. And my sergeant said, well, you can't do that for the officers, you must do it for all ranks. And I thought it was too premature to do it for all ranks. And so I said, all right, well, let me think about it. And I went, I thought about it, and I said, they came back the next day to my staff and said, if anybody, I'm going on with this, and if anybody at home in London questions it, my answer is that I do it, start with, for the officers, and for one thing, I want to encourage more people to become officers. And that answer was accepted. You know, that's what we did. But there were problems with relationships as time went on between the troops and the German population. And eventually, of course, the whole all the rules against fraternization were removed. But that's what I did. I did it for relax them for officers to start with, as a start, because I had more confidence that the officers would behave themselves. And also, as I said, my official reply was because I wanted to encourage more of the other ranks to become officers.
Could I ask you now about your relationship with the Control Commission? Because I imagine you would have interacted with them quite a lot regarding the German rearmament.
Well, regarding that, and more particularly about relationships with the German population, I mean, the use of training areas and the financial arrangements and so on. Particularly, I suppose, on the training facilities and the training areas, the use of large areas for big exercises, and there was discussion, the financial arrangements about that, and there were a good deal of discussions. I got to know Ivan Kirkpatrick very well, and he was very good to work with, and also the French High Commissioner, François Poncet. And what's the name of the, I can't remember the name of the American, who was very good too. They were all sensible and easy to work with, although in some respects requirements and our views were different, of course, but we had to iron them out in discussion. But generally speaking, I think the relationships between the Control Commission as a commission and me and my staff were good. There were problems, which we discussed, and in some cases we weren't able to get our way and they weren't able to get their way. But on the whole, it worked reasonably well.
Would you say that the rearmament issue, you know, the rearmament of Germany, was it a very sensitive one at that time?
Well, I don't know about on the political front. I suppose, yes, I think it was, because people were doubtful about it. It did have both political and psychological problems. And I'm quite sure, although I had no evidence of it at the time, as far as I can recollect, that the Russians in particular would have been very worried about it. But it was, in my opinion, a necessary move, progress, in order to make certain that the NATO defense system was complete. A NATO system, if defense system, without the inclusion of Germany and the development of German armed forces, wouldn't have made any sense, any strategic sense at all. So it was a necessary thing, but it obviously, for political and psychological reasons, it had to be progressed very slowly and cautiously.
Historians often say that the Korean War was instrumental in pushing forward German rearmament. Do you think you would agree with that?
I've no reason to agree or disagree. I don't know.
The fact that, you know, the Americans
were... I don't know. Maybe it did. I don't know. I think probably... probably it highlighted the need for closer allied cooperation, and it did highlight the need to bring Germany and the German armed forces into the NATO setup. I don't know.
Could I ask you now about the relief operations in Germany at that time? Did you have any contact at all with these?
Yes, well, there were, at that time when I went out there, there were in Germany, in my area, quite a number of camps of displaced persons. They were all types, I mean, Latvians, Poles, Czechs, people who'd been forced into the German labor camps and labor organizations during the war. They were refugees. They were called displaced persons. The plans had been worked out by had been carried out to get them the ones that were fit to accepted by some of the Allied countries, particularly America, and we'd accepted some, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. But this left a residue of, quite a large residue of people, refugees, men, women, and children, who were not acceptable for that sort of thing to be incorporated into the communities of other Allied countries. Because there were some illness, or they were tubercular, or for some reason or other of health. And there were these large numbers of people of that kind in these camps being looked after by the German civil administration. And the Allied military government, I suppose, had a voice in it. And my wife got to know about these, and she was approached by two or three of the good ladies, like people like Sue Ryder and so on, and Joyce, whatever her name was, now I can't remember the names, to with a suggestion that the British troops, the officers and the wives of the British troops, officers and other ranks, wives, should visit these camps and take an interest in them. So she, with the help from these good ladies, and particularly from somebody called, what was her name now? Anyway, I can't remember, a Belgian girl who had been a refugee, and they set up My wife had meetings with the the wives of senior officers in the different areas, brigades, division brigades, and so on. And they created an organization for regular visiting to these camps by British wives from all sections, all the units in Rhine Army, and they did it excellently. In fact, some of them, in one case, my wife found that in one place where there was one of these displaced persons camps, in a unit area, the wives of the people in that that unit in that area had already started visiting them, and they arranged for helping with the children and so on, and pressed, of course, for them to be progressively incorporated into the German economy and community. This was a long and difficult process, and my wife worked very hard at it, and she was very well supported by the wives of the British wives throughout Rhine Army. And also she had meetings with John Hope, for example, in the Foreign Office about it all. And that was a very valuable welfare, and was very much appreciated. Francois Rigby was the name of the Belgian girl, and she got my wife to help her in setting up an organization which later they called Lifeline. And that did excellent work in getting children adopted by families adopted by families, English families, and so on. And gradually the thing was worked out, and they all worked very hard at it and did, I think, splendid work. I don't say that. My wife was very pleased with the support she got, organizations.
This is the lady who worked with Sue Ryder. Joyce, yes. We can look her name
up. There was
up.
A New Zealand girl, a lady, who also, they came to my wife about it. She was rather taken aback to start with, because she didn't really know what the problems were, what the political significance of the whole thing was, and what sort of people she was going to run into, and what the German commandant of the various camps were like, and how easy or not they would be to deal with. But gradually it worked out, and it was very good, I think.
Did you ever come up against this sort of issue regarding the repatriation of so-called Russian citizens on German soil?
No.
That didn't come into
your
sphere?
No, I didn't know anything of that. There's nothing of that kind occurred while I was there. I think it had all been done before. No, I didn't. No, I had no, anything. At the end of the war in Italy, there were none of those people in my command in Northeast, in Venezia Giulia. They were all up in Austria. No, I didn't have anything to do with it.
How had the rebuilding of Germany progressed when you were there in 1951?
Yes, well, my impression was that they were working very hard and very successfully and very quickly at it. And, of course, we were involved in it to a certain extent, because we wanted married quarters for the married men in Rhine Army. And that, again, was a problem on the financial side, both with the War Office and the High Commission and the Control Commission. Actually, the siting and the ownership, so to speak, of the buildings and married quarters. But after argument, discussion, negotiation, it worked out all right. And I think it was ended up pretty satisfactorily. But there were problems, of course, there bound to be, when you've got an army living in a foreign country with a population, civil population. Which had been originally hostile, but patience and tolerance, these things do work out, and that, I think, is the lesson from it all, to be quite firm in what the requirements are, but to be patient and tolerant in arrangements to achieve them.
Of course, the Berlin Wall hadn't been erected in those days, had it?
No.
Were you getting any problems about the sort of population change between East and West?
No, we had... I went up to Berlin, of course. The garrison there, the British garrison there, was part of my responsibilities, and I went up, I think, two or three times and saw them there and discussed their various problems with them. There were problems there too, particularly in the relationships between the British, American, and Russian commanders. But again, then there was the problem. I'm not quite sure. Well, I don't think I was there during the airlift, but I'm not sure. Anyway, there were problems of the arrangements together about the relationships with the civil population, the freedom of movement, but the Berlin Wall hadn't been built, and things hadn't hardened, I don't think, in those days to the same extent that they have since.
Of course, while you were in Germany, there was a change of government in Britain, wasn't there? The Conservatives took over from Labour. Did that make any difference at all? You know, were you, with your interaction with the various politicians, how had you got on with the Labour people?
Oh, I got on all right. I had a number of, I don't think very many, but a few meetings with Attlee.
What did you think of Attlee?
I thought he not a very, he wasn't a very sort of impressive person to meet, but he was very decisive. In the sense that he would reach the citizens and see them carried through, but he wasn't a very impressive personality. But you knew that he listened to what you had to say, and then reached his own conclusions and decisions. And he was, I think, good at making decisions and seeing them implemented. I didn't have very much contact with him, not as much as I did with Winston Churchill at a later stage when I was CIJS.
Did you have any contact with Ernest Bevin, the Foreign Secretary?
I remember meeting him, but nothing of any consequence.
How about, was it James Griffiths who would have been the Colonial Secretary when you were in Malaya?
Yeah.
Did you have much contact
with
him?
Well, he and John Strachey, who was then Minister, Secretary of State for War, they came out to Singapore when I was Commander-in-Chief out there, so I met them both and knew them both. I had more dealings with John Strachey than with Jim Griffiths, of course. And... Strachey was an interesting character, but a difficult character. He's a high, very high-level intellectual. And this ought to have been done before. I ought to have told you this before.
Yeah.
When he came out, he sent a message in advance to say that he would like to meet the troops informally. And so I told my staff to send out instructions that when he visited the unit, they were to have, at the end of his visit, when he'd been shown round and everything, what was going on, they were to have a cross-section of other ranks, a warrant officer, a sergeant, perhaps a couple of corporals and a couple of private soldiers, in the canteen to meet him, so that he'd get to talk to them informally. And what used to happen was that after walking round, I went with him, we walked round the units, all the accommodations, all the whatever they were doing, and then went along to the canteen led by Loretta Mendelssohn Major, of course, to call the party to attention. And I would say, well, I'd sit down, and then ask the Secretary of State to sit down and talk to him, but he was reluctant to sit down, and he found it extremely difficult to talk to them. In fact, he found it almost impossible to talk to them. And this worried him a lot. And after two or three of these occasions, he said to me, I don't seem to be able to make contact with these people. He said, they'll talk to you, all right, but they don't seem ready to talk to me in any way. What's the problem? So I said, well, sir, I think that the problem is that they look upon you as their boss, and you look upon them as your constituents. And this is not an easy relationship. Not to that, he improved and he relaxed. But he was an extraordinary, he was a very odd character. I think my wife had a lot of discussion and argument with him about public schools, for example, because he was at Eton and my wife disapproved of the public school system, and he thought it was all right. She said, how did you get on at Eton? He said, well, not very well, but then I was a very peculiar boy. That sort of thing. And so he was difficult, but I think he learned quite a bit. And then he went up to Hong Kong, and I had a meeting of a cross section of the garrison there to meet him and for him to talk to. And I didn't tell him until we went into the room that the press had been invited, and I did. And so he got very much, very cross, he got cross-examined by the press, particularly about the accommodation facilities and married quarters and things like that in Hong Kong. No, he was an odd chap and difficult, but I think I got on all right with him, and my wife told him that, told him what she thought of the socialists. I knew, I suppose, like one does know on the grapevine, that I was a candidate or possible candidate, what Monty called, was in the paddock, for the appointment at CIDS. And Brian Robertson, who I also knew very well, and who had, we'd worked together in the Italian campaign when I was chief of staff and he was chief administrative officer, so we were very good friends. I knew that he was the other one under consideration. I knew that. And then I was bidden to go back to have lunch with the Prime Minister. And Alexander was the Minister of Defence at that time, of course, whom I knew very well. And I went to number 10, and I was greeted by Alexander, who said, well, we've just come back from a Defence Committee meeting, and the Prime Minister's washing his hands. He'll be there here in a moment or two, but tell me how are things in Rhine Army. I said, well, I'm very pleased indeed, and I think it's an excellent thing that the Army, and particularly the young National Service soldiers, seem to take a great interest in their training, and indeed in large-scale exercises, which are often very boring from a private soldier's point of view. And then at that moment, the Prime Minister came in, and I was presented to him by Alexander. I had met him before in Italy. And Alexander said, well, John Harding tells me that the troops in Germany take great interest in their exercises. Upon the Prime Minister said, oh, what? Sham fights? And I said, oh, yes, sir. And then we started on long stories from him, a series of stories from him about his experiences in the OTC at Harrow. And that took us into lunch and the early part of the lunch. And then that discussion on that died away, and the Prime Minister and I happened to remember that the Prime Minister had been with the Royal Naval Division in the Amsterdam area in the First World War. And also we had recently we're still working on our new base area in the Amsterdam. So I mentioned this to the Prime Minister, and then, of course, that carried us on through the rest of lunch, factored in his talking about the Royal Naval Division and their activities and the First World War and the early days of it and so on. And that went on until somebody came in, one of his staff came in and told him it was time for him to leave to go and vote in the local government election which was going on at that stage. So I never got asked any questions at all about my views about the modern army and the problems of the army and about re-equipment or operational effectiveness and the job of the Rhine Army in Germany and so on. So I don't know whether it's already been decided that I should be offered the job of CIJS, but at any rate, I never got asked any questions, any difficult questions at all. And then soon after that luncheon party, I was told that I was to succeed Bill Slim as CIJS. And one thing in particular I think I would like to mention is that although Brian Robertson knew that he had also been under consideration for the job, he remained a very close friend of mine, and he never showed any sign to me of disappointment or jealousy of any kind. He was a wonderful friend, a wonderful comrade, and I would like to put that on the record. I think he did.
This is Anthony Eden.
Anthony Eden, yes, I think he did. I don't know the detail. I think he did. I think he thought that it was a mistake to make a change in command of Rhine Army soon after. I'd only been there just over the year when I had to come away to take over CIJS. And, of course, the same problem arose when I was... had made very strong recommendations that General Templer should go and command Rhine Army when he came away from Malaya in order to get experience of the NATO setup and the situation in the military situation in Germany and Western Europe before he came and succeeded me as CIJS, and that was very strongly opposed by Eden, and in fact Eden won his case in that particular instance. Now,
how did you get on with Anthony Eden? Did you like him?
Oh, very well. Yeah, very well. And I got to know him, of course, even better when he took over. I knew him fairly well. I, after all, I went to Bangkok with him and traveled out with him, was at a meeting with him in Cairo with NASA on our way to Bangkok in Karachi and meetings there and then throughout the first meetings of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. I was with him in discussions he had with Foster Dulles about the offshore islands and the future policy, political strategic policy in the Middle East. Yes, I got to know him very well. I had a very high regard for him, of course. He was a very good man to work with. I think he was rather, if I ventured, and I shouldn't criticize him, I think he was rather anxious to get agreement for agreement's sake without necessarily going into all the significances and implications of whatever was agreed. And then, of course, when he took over as Prime Minister to start with, I got the impression that he had shuffled off, so to speak, his foreign office diplomatic approach, and was prepared and ready to make robust and difficult decisions. But then his health began to deteriorate, and unfortunately, that.